As the French scholars Charles Gide and Charles Riest explained in their book, A History of Economic Doctrines,
this conception of spontaneity in Adam Smith was no abstract theory that needed the backing of a rigid demonstration. It was a belief gradually borne in upon him in the course of his review of the economic field. This is characteristic of all his thought, and with every new vista we are reminded of it. The conclusion is hinted at again and again, and the impression left upon the reader's mind is that no other conclusion could ever be possible. Smith thought of the economic order as the creation of 1,000 human wills, unconscious of the end whither they are tending.
Adam Smith believes man is part of the natural universe, with natural laws, laws of cause and effect, regulating the consequences of human behavior. And just as the physical universe exhibits a natural order, so human beings interacting in society exhibit a natural order. It is the purpose of economic science, Smith believes, to investigate the natural laws of wealth and exchange. This investigation, in the able hands of Adam Smith, uncovers a self-regulating market. The Wealth of Nations is a systematic exposition of spontaneous order in the field of economics. We're now ready to plunge into some technical arguments contained in The Wealth of Nations. This can be a sobering experience. Smith's theories are sometimes difficult, sometimes inconsistent, and sometimes just flat wrong. But they nearly always relate to his fascination with the invisible hand. So if we can relate his technical theories to his interest in spontaneous order, we have a reference point to work from, and this will aid our understanding of what Smith is doing. Moreover, even if a particular answer by Smith is wrong, we can still appreciate the importance of the question. We can search for a better answer, as later economists have done. And we can appreciate the grand structure of the Wealth of Nations, even if we disagree with some of its parts. Book 1 of The Wealth of Nations is entitled Of the Causes of Improvement in the Productive Powers of Labor and of the Order According to Which Its Produce is Naturally Distributed Among the Different Ranks of the People. It opens with this famous line.
The greatest improvement in the productive powers of labor and the greater part of the skill, dexterity, and judgment with which it is anywhere applied seem to have been the effects of the division of labor.
Adam Smith was not the first modern thinker to stress the division of labor. That distinction belongs to the 17th century writer Sir William Petty.
In a vast city, manufacturers will beget one another, and each manufacturer will be divided into as many parts as possible, whereby the work of each artisan will be simple and easy. As for example, in the making of a watch, if one man shall make the wheels, another the spring, another shall engrave the dial plate, and another shall make the cases, then the watch will be better and cheaper than if the whole work be put upon any one man.
Although previous thinkers, going back as far as Plato, mentioned the division of labor, Adam Smith emphasized and analyzed it more than any of his predecessors. Smith illustrates the division of labor with a pin factory, an example also used by previous English and French writers. This trifling manufacture, as Smith calls it, was housed in a single workhouse and thereby permits us to observe the division of labor in a straightforward way. After we understand the principles involved, we can apply them to more complex forms of industry and a society as a whole.
In those great manufacturers, which are destined to supply the great wants of the great body of the people, every different branch of the work employs so great a number of workmen that it is impossible to collect them all into the same workhouse. We can seldom see more at one time than those employed in one single branch. Though in such manufactures, therefore, the work may really be divided into a much greater number of parts than in those of a more trifling nature, the division is not near so obvious, and has accordingly been much less observed.
18 distinct operations, Smith estimates, are involved in the making of pins.
One man draws out the wire. Another straights it. A third cuts it. A fourth points it. A fifth grinds it at the top for receiving the head. To make the head requires two or three distinct operations. To put it on is a peculiar business. To whiten the pins is another. It is even a trade by itself to put them into the paper. And the important business of making a pin is, in this manner, divided into about 18 distinct operations.
Smith estimates that a single laborer, working alone, could not make 20 pins in a day, and perhaps not even a single pin. 10 laborers, however, using the division of labor, can make 48,000 pins in a day. This works out to 4,800 pins for each laborer, and represents an increase in the productivity of labor of at least 240 times, and perhaps 4,800 times.
In every other art and manufacture, the effects of the division of labor are similar to what they are in this very trifling one, though in many of them the labor can neither be so much subdivided nor reduced to so great a simplicity of operation. The division of labor, however, so far as it can be introduced, occasions in every art a proportionable increase of the productive powers of labor.
How does the division of labor increase productivity? Smith assigns three reasons.
First, the improvement of the dexterity of the workman necessarily increases the quantity of the work he can perform. And the division of labor, by reducing every man's business to some one simple operation, and by making this operation the sole employment of his life, necessarily increases very much the dexterity of the workman.
Second, argues Smith, time is saved under the division of labor, which would otherwise be lost in passing from one kind of work to another. For example, when a country weaver who cultivates a small farm stops weaving and takes up the plow, he loses considerable time in the transition. Also, when we shift from one task to another, we are apt to saunter a little, as Smith puts it. It takes time to gear up our minds to the new task, and this time is saved when individuals focus on one task in the division of labor.
Thirdly, and lastly, everybody must be sensible how much labor is facilitated and abridged by the application of proper machinery. The invention of all those machines by which labor is so much facilitated and abridged seems to have been originally owing to the division of labor. Men are much more likely to discover easier and readier methods of attaining any object when the whole attention of their minds is directed towards that single object than when it is dissipated among a great variety of things.
Many improvements in machinery, Smith believes, originated with specialized workers who knew their jobs better than anyone else.
A great part of the machines made use of in those manufactures in which labor is most subdivided were originally the inventions of common workmen, who, being each of them employed in some very simple operation, naturally turned their thoughts towards finding out easier and readier methods of performing it.
Smith gives an interesting example of this inventive spirit among laborers.
In the first fire engine, a boy was constantly employed to open and shut, alternately, the communication between the boiler and the cylinder, according as the piston either ascended or descended. One of those boys, who loved to play with his companions, observed that by tying a string from the handle of the valve which opened this communication to another part of the machine, the valve would open and shut without his assistance, and leave him at liberty to divert himself with his playfellows. One of the greatest improvements that has been made upon this machine since it was first invented was, in this manner, the discovery of a boy who wanted to save his own labor.
We see how the division of labor increases productivity by improving the skill of individual workmen, by decreasing production time, and by encouraging labor-saving inventions and innovations. The average member of an advanced society may expend less physical energy than the average member of a primitive society. But labor in an advanced society is far more productive than labor in a primitive society, owing to the division of labor.
It is the great multiplication of the productions of all the different arts, in consequence of the division of labor, which occasions, in a well-governed society, that universal opulence which extends itself to the lowest ranks of the people. Every workman has a great quantity of his own work to dispose of, beyond what he himself has occasion for, and every other workman being exactly in the same situation, he is enabled to exchange a great quantity of his own goods for a great quantity, or what comes to the same thing, for the price of a great quantity of theirs. He supplies them abundantly with what they have occasion for, and they accommodate him as amply with what he has occasion for. And a general plenty diffuses itself through all the different ranks of the society.
The division of labor is the principal cause of the improvement of the productive powers of labor, and it is a classic example of spontaneous order.
This division of labor, from which so many advantages are derived, is not originally the effect of any human wisdom, which foresees and intends that general opulence to which it gives occasion. It is the necessary, though very slow and gradual consequence, of a certain propensity in human nature which has in view no such extensive utility, the propensity to truck, barter, and exchange one thing for another.
Is this propensity to truck, barter, and exchange a primary element of human nature? Although Smith does not commit himself to a definite answer, he does give important indications.
Whether this propensity be one of those original principles in human nature, of which no further account can be given, or whether, as seems more probable, it be the necessary consequence of the faculties of reason and speech, it belongs not to our present subject to inquire. It is common to all men, and to be found in no other race of animals, which seem to know neither this nor any other species of contracts.
This passage contains important information. According to Smith, the disposition to exchange is probably the necessary consequence of the faculties of reason and speech. It is a kind of contract found only among human beings. Let's look at these claims in more detail. In his Glasgow Lectures of 1763, Smith suggests that the propensity to truck, barter, and exchange springs from the desire to persuade.
If we should inquire into the principle in the human mind on which this disposition of trucking is founded, it is clearly the natural inclination everyone has to persuade. The offering of a shilling, which to us appears to have so plain and simple a meaning, is, in reality, offering an argument to persuade one to do so-and-so, as it is for his interest.
People have natural wants, including food, shelter, and clothing. You can best satisfy these wants, Smith believes, by interacting with other people in society. But will other people give you what you want automatically? No, of course not. You must persuade them. How? By offering something they want. You will truck, barter, and exchange with other people, Smith says, as a means of persuasion.
Whoever offers to another a bargain of any kind proposes to do this. Give me that which I want, and you shall have this which you want, is the meaning of every such offer. And it is in this manner that we obtain from one another the far greater part of those good offices which we stand in need of.
We have seen how Smith attributes the propensity to truck, barter, and exchange to the faculties of reason and speech. Now we can better understand this claim. Reason is the ability to think abstractly. Speech is the ability to communicate. By reasoning and by communicating with other people, we learn several things. We learn we can benefit from other people. We learn we can persuade them to help us. And we learn we can offer something in exchange, something they want, as a means of persuasion. This propensity, Smith argues, is found in all humans, but in no other animals. Exchange requires reason and speech, faculties peculiar to the human species. Exchange is a kind of contract or voluntary agreement. Because only man can argue, persuade, and agree, only man can use contracts to further his interests.
Two greyhounds, in running down the same hare, have sometimes the appearance of acting in some sort of concert. Each turns her towards his companion, or endeavors to intercept her when his companion turns her towards himself. This, however, is not the effect of any contract, but of the accidental concurrence of their passions in the same object at that particular time. Nobody ever saw a dog make a fair and deliberate exchange of one bone for another with another dog. Nobody ever saw one animal by its gestures and natural cries signify to another, "This is mine, that yours. I am willing to give this for that." When an animal wants to obtain something either of a man or of another animal, it has no other means of persuasion but to gain the favor of those whose service it requires.
Humans occasionally act the same way. We try to get what we want from others through servile and fawning attention. But we need things from a great many people, far more than we could ever befriend.
In civilized society, man stands at all times in need of the cooperation and assistance of great multitudes. While his whole life is scarce sufficient to gain the friendship of a few persons. In almost every other race of animals, each individual, when it is grown up to maturity, is entirely independent, and in its natural state has occasion for the assistance of no other living creature. But man has almost constant occasion for the help of his brethren, and it is in vain for him to expect it from their benevolence only. He will be more likely to prevail if he can interest their self-love in his favor, and show them that it is for their own advantage to do for him what he requires of them.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over and begin side two. Here is an outline of Smith's arguments so far in a series of questions and answers. What is the primary cause of a nation's wealth? The productivity of human labor. What causes labor to become more productive? The division of labor. What causes the division of labor? The propensity to truck, barter, and exchange. What causes this propensity? A desire to persuade other people. What causes this desire to persuade? A desire for the assistance of others in society. What causes this desire? The knowledge gained through reason and communication that social cooperation is the best way to satisfy our wants, that is, to pursue our self-interest. This complex, ingenious argument has many byways and detours, but we should not be distracted from Smith's basic purpose, to show how economic wealth is generated by a spontaneous order. Each link in the causal chain brings us closer to the pursuit of self-interest. No great plan or foresight inspired the division of labor, that powerful engine of economic progress. Next, Adam Smith turns his attention to the origin and use of money. Money, a medium of exchange, is an essential institution for any society with an advanced division of labor. And, like the division of labor, money evolves spontaneously as people endeavor to better their condition through exchange.
When the division of labor has been once thoroughly established, it is but a very small part of a man's wants which the produce of his own labor can supply. He supplies the far greater part of them by exchanging that surplus part of the produce of his own labor, which is over and above his own consumption, for such parts of the produce of other men's labors as he has occasion for. Every man thus lives by exchanging, or becomes in some measure a merchant, and the society itself grows to be what is properly a commercial society.
Suppose the butcher has more meat than he can consume. Suppose the brewer and baker want this surplus meat and are willing to trade their beer and bread for it. An exchange might occur if the butcher wants beer and bread, and if the parties can agree on the appropriate amounts of meat, beer, and bread to exchange. But this kind of barter is inconvenient. Suppose the butcher has all the beer and bread he needs. No exchange will occur here, because the brewer and baker have nothing the butcher wants.
No exchange can, in this case, be made between them. The butcher cannot be their merchant, nor they his customer. And they are all of them thus mutually less serviceable to one another. In order to avoid the inconveniency of such situations, every prudent man in every period of society, after the first establishment of the division of labor, must naturally have endeavored to manage his affairs in such a manner as to have at all times by him, besides the peculiar produce of his own industry, a certain quantity of some one commodity or other, such as he imagined few people would be likely to refuse in exchange for the produce of their industry.
Different societies have used different commodities for the purpose of exchange.
In the rude ages of society, cattle are said to have been the common instrument of commerce. Salt is said to be the common instrument of commerce in Abyssinia, a species of shells in some parts of the coast of India, dried cod at Newfoundland, tobacco in Virginia, sugar in some of our West India colonies, hides or dressed leather in some other countries. And there is, at this day, a village in Scotland where it is not uncommon, I am told, for a workman to carry nails instead of money to the baker shop or the alehouse.
As societies evolve, such commodities may prove inadequate for the needs of commerce. They may be perishable, or they may be difficult to divide into equal parts for the purpose of exchange. This is why precious metals eventually come to be accepted as a common medium of exchange.
In all countries, men seem at last to have been determined, by irresistible reasons, to give the preference to metals above every other commodity. Metals can not only be kept with as little loss as any other commodity, scarce anything being less perishable than they are, but they can likewise, without any loss, be divided into any number of parts, as by fusion those can easily be reunited again, a quality which no other equally durable commodities possess, and which, more than any other quality, renders them fit to be the instruments of commerce and circulation.
Barter, Smith argues, will clog the wheels of exchange, so people eventually turn to precious metals.
The man who wanted to buy salt, for example, and had nothing but cattle to give in exchange for it, must have been obliged to buy salt to the value of a whole ox, or a whole sheep at a time. He could seldom buy less than this, because what he was to give for it could seldom be divided without loss. And if he had a mind to buy more, he must, for the same reasons, have been obliged to buy double, or triple the quantity, the value, to wit, of two or three oxen, or of two or three sheep. If, on the contrary, instead of sheep or oxen, he had metals to give in exchange for it, he could easily proportion the quantity of the metal to the precise quantity of the commodity which he had immediate occasion for.
Precious metals, durable and divisible, gradually emerged as the medium of exchange without an overall plan or design. But these metals can be inconvenient as well, notably when it comes to assessing their weight and quality. It is excessively troublesome, says Smith, to weigh a metal every time we make an exchange. And it is nearly impossible for the ordinary person to determine the purity of a precious metal. These inconveniences, therefore, led to the development of coined money.
Before the institution of coined money, people must always have been liable to the grossest frauds and impositions. And instead of a pound weight of pure silver or pure copper, might receive in exchange for their goods an adulterated composition of the coarsest and cheapest materials, which had, however, in their outward appearance, been made to resemble those metals. To prevent such abuses, to facilitate exchanges, and thereby to encourage all sorts of industry and commerce, it has been found necessary in all countries that have made any considerable advances towards improvement to affix a public stamp upon certain quantities of such particular metals as were in those countries commonly made use of to purchase goods. Hence the origin of coined money, and of those public offices called mints. All of them are meant to ascertain, by means of a public stamp, the quantity and uniform goodness of those different commodities when brought to market.
Government, Smith believes, should preserve the integrity of money. But as often as not, governments have betrayed this responsibility by debasing the coinage.
In every country of the world, I believe, the avarice and injustice of princes and sovereign states, abusing the confidence of their subjects, have, by degrees, diminished the real quantity of metal which had been originally contained in their coins. By means of those operations, the princes and sovereign states which performed them were enabled, in appearance, to pay their debts and to fulfill their engagements with a smaller quantity of silver than would otherwise have been requisite. It was, indeed, in appearance only, for their creditors were really defrauded of a part of what was due to them.
Adam Smith has now completed the first leg of his spontaneous order theory. He has shown how, beginning with the pursuit of individual self-interest, we can explain the division of labor, economic exchange, the transition from barter to money, and the emergence of coined money. These institutions benefit society as a whole, but it was self-interest, not a concern for the public good, that caused their development. These beneficial institutions, as Adam Ferguson put it, were the result of human action, but not the execution of any human design. Adam Smith has discussed the division of labor, exchange, and money as a medium of exchange, and he has treated them as part of a natural economic order. Now he pushes his inquiry further. What are the natural rules, he asks, which regulate exchange?
What are the rules which men naturally observe in exchanging goods, either for money or for one another, I shall now proceed to examine. These rules determine what may be called the relative or exchangeable value of goods.
Significantly, Adam Smith mentions the rules of exchange which men naturally observe. When Smith uses the word natural or naturally in this context, he means something which flows from the natural impulse of self-interest. A natural rule of exchange, therefore, is a rule emerging from self-regarding actions in a spontaneous order. This is an important point. To suggest that exchange has natural rules or natural laws is to suggest that a free market is not chaotic, but displays order and regularity. And, as with all principles of spontaneous order, these natural rules of exchange are not designed or imposed. The natural rules of exchange, according to Smith, determine the relative or exchangeable value of goods. What is exchange value? Smith answers this by contrasting the value something has in use with the value something has in exchange.
The word value, it is to be observed, has two different meanings, and sometimes expresses the utility of some particular object, and sometimes the power of purchasing other goods which the possession of that object conveys. The one may be called value in use, the other value in exchange.
Smith uses the example of water and diamonds to illustrate the difference between value in use and value in exchange.
The things which have the greatest value in use have frequently little or no value in exchange. And on the contrary, those which have the greatest value in exchange have frequently little or no value in use. Nothing is more useful than water, but it will purchase scarce anything. Scarce anything can be had in exchange for it. A diamond, on the contrary, has scarce any value in use, but a very great quantity of other goods may frequently be had in exchange for it.
This example, which received a good deal of attention from later economists, is known as the water-diamond paradox. Adam Smith did not originate this paradox, nor did he even call it a paradox. The so-called water diamond paradox was discussed by many writers during the 17th and 18th centuries, including Smith's instructor at the University of Glasgow, Francis Hutcheson. And despite the term paradox attached to this example by later economists, Adam Smith is not troubled by it in The Wealth of Nations. He offers it to illustrate a point, the difference between use value and exchange value. He does not offer it as a paradox or problem to be resolved. While lecturing at the University of Glasgow many years before the appearance of The Wealth of Nations, Smith gave the same explanation of the water diamond paradox as his predecessors, including his former teacher, Francis Hutcheson. Diamonds command a higher price than water, Smith says, because they are far scarcer.
Cheapness is, in fact, the same thing with plenty. It is only on account of the plenty of water that it is so cheap as to be got for the lifting, and on account of the scarcity of diamonds that they are so dear.
The market price, Smith explains, is determined by the abundance or scarcity of a commodity in proportion to the demand for it, and he again offers diamonds as an example.
If the commodity be scarce, the price is raised. But if the quantity be more than is sufficient to supply the demand, the price falls. Thus it is that diamonds and other precious stones are dear, while iron, which is much more useful, is so many times cheaper.
In his Glasgow lectures, Smith tells the story of a rich merchant stranded in the Arabian desert, where water is extremely scarce. Ordinarily, this merchant would refuse to pay anything for water, but in the desert, he gladly pays an enormous sum. The market price of water, diamonds, and other commodities, Smith believes, depends on their relative scarcity. After stating the difference between use value and exchange value in The Wealth of Nations, Smith outlines his task for the next three chapters.
In order to investigate the principles which regulate the exchangeable value of commodities, I shall endeavor to show, first, what is the real measure of this exchangeable value, or wherein consists the real price of commodities. Secondly, what are the different parts of which this real price is composed or made up? And lastly, what are the different circumstances which sometimes raise some or all of these different parts of price above and sometimes sink them below their natural or ordinary rate? Or what are the causes which sometimes hinder the market price, that is, the actual price of commodities, from coinciding exactly with what may be called their natural price?
Adam Smith's theory of value is the most difficult, perplexing, and controversial part of The Wealth of Nations. Scholars have spilled ink by the gallon in a tortured effort to figure out exactly what Adam Smith believed. Smith held a labor theory of value, say some economists. No, say others, he did not. Smith emphasized production in his value theory and neglected the role of demand, say some economists. No, say others, he was well aware of the role of demand. Smith's wrong-headed approach to value threw economic science off track for nearly a century, say some economists. No, say others, he made significant contributions and advances. Smith defended a cost of production theory, say some economists. No, say others, he defended a labor command theory. No, no, say others, Adam Smith was hopelessly confused in his theory of value. He used at least four conflicting theories of value in different places. And so it goes, as scholars wrestle with Adam Smith's difficult answers to difficult questions. It has been said that if you took all the economists in the world and placed them end to end, they still would not reach a conclusion. Nowhere is this more true than in their interpretations of Smith's theory of value. Adam Smith anticipated the trouble his readers might have in following his discussion of value.
I must very earnestly entreat both the patience and attention of the reader. His patience, in order to examine a detail which may perhaps in some places appear unnecessarily tedious, and his attention, in order to understand what may perhaps, after the fullest explication which I am capable of giving of it, appear still in some degree obscure. I am always willing to run some hazard of being tedious in order to be sure that I am perspicuous. And after taking the utmost pains that I can to be perspicuous, some obscurity may still appear to remain upon a subject in its own nature extremely abstracted.
Thus does Adam Smith proceed to his next subject, exchange value and the natural rules which regulate exchange value in a free market. He begins like this.
Every man is rich or poor according to the degree in which he can afford to enjoy the necessaries, conveniences, and amusements of human life. But, after the division of labor has once thoroughly taken place, it is but a very small part of these with which a man's own labor can supply him. The far greater part of them he must derive from the labor of other people. And he must be rich or poor according to the quantity of that labor which he can command, or which he can afford to purchase. The value of any commodity, therefore, to the person who possesses it, and who means not to use or consume it himself, but to exchange it for other commodities, is equal to the quantity of labor which it enables him to purchase or command. Labor, therefore, is the real measure of the exchangeable value of all commodities.
Notice that when Smith refers to the value of a commodity in this passage, he immediately adds the qualification to the person who possesses it. So what Smith appears to be saying is this. If you possess a commodity which you intend to exchange for something else, you need some measure or standard to determine whether the exchange is worthwhile. And this standard, Smith maintains, is human labor. As Smith continues his difficult argument, observe again how he uses phrases like, to the man who wants to acquire it, to the man who has acquired it, and to those who possess it. Clearly, Smith is referring to the decision-making process of an individual who is contemplating an exchange.
The real price of everything, what everything really costs to the man who wants to acquire it, is the toil and trouble of acquiring it. What everything is really worth to the man who has acquired it, and who wants to dispose of it or exchange it for something else, is the toil and trouble which it can save to himself, and which it can impose upon other people. What is bought with money, or with goods, is purchased by labor as much as what we acquire by the toil of our own body. That money, or those goods, indeed save us this toil. They contain the value of a certain quantity of labor which we exchange for what is supposed, at the time, to contain the value of an equal quantity.
Let's try to simplify Smith's argument with an illustration. Like all human beings, you must labor to acquire the various things you need to survive and prosper. But in a society with a division of labor, you can acquire what you need only through exchange. Now suppose you're a baker with extra bread, and you would like to trade this bread for beer. Your friend the brewer just happens to have a gallon of extra beer, and he is looking for some bread. Fine. He has something you want, you have something he wants. So we have conditions necessary for exchange. But how much bread should you give up for a gallon of beer? What measure or standard can you use to ascertain the value of your bread relative to a gallon of beer? This is the problem of determining the exchange values of bread and beer. Suppose the brewer wants 50 loaves of bread for his gallon of beer. You want the beer, but you ask yourself if the exchange is worthwhile at this price. How can you decide this? Well, both bread and beer require labor to produce. It took a certain quantity of labor, as Smith puts it, to produce your bread. You purchased your bread with your labor. A quantity of labor, as Smith says, was the first price, the original purchase money that was paid for your bread.
Labor was the first price, the original purchase money that was paid for all things. It was not by gold or by silver, but by labor, that all the wealth of the world was originally purchased. And its value to those who possess it, and who want to exchange it for some new productions, is precisely equal to the quantity of labor which it can enable them to purchase or command.
According to Smith, you will make an exchange only if you believe the quantity of labor invested in the gallon of beer you want is at least equal to the quantity of labor invested in the 50 loaves of bread you have to give up. Labor is your measure of exchange value. Meanwhile, your friend the brewer is thinking the same way. He has purchased his beer with his labor, and this quantity of labor is what the beer is really worth to him. So, even if he wants your bread, he will give up his beer only if he thinks your bread contains an equal quantity of labor. Exchange will occur, according to Smith, only if the traders believe they are getting an equal amount of labor value. But is this true? Wouldn't you, the baker, be willing to exchange if you were getting beer with greater labor value than your bread? Yes, of course, but your friend the brewer wouldn't go along, so no exchange would occur. And you wouldn't go along if the situation were reversed. Exchange will occur when the quantities of labor in the bread and beer are equal. This is what Adam Smith means when he says that labor is a measure that regulates the exchangeable value of commodities. The baker and brewer regulate their decisions to exchange or not using labor as their measure of exchange value. But immediately after presenting this argument, Smith seems to undercut it with a serious qualification. In the ordinary course of exchange, he says, there is no practical way to employ labor as a measure of exchange value.
But though labor be the real measure of the exchangeable value of all commodities, it is not that by which their value is commonly estimated. It is often difficult to ascertain the proportion between two different quantities of labor. The time spent in two different sorts of work will not always alone determine this proportion. The different degrees of hardship endured and of ingenuity exercised must likewise be taken into account. There may be more labor in an hour's hard work than in 2 hours' easy business, or in an hour's application to a trade which it cost 10 years to learn, than in a month's industry at an ordinary and obvious employment. But it is not easy to find any accurate measure, either of hardship or ingenuity. In exchanging, indeed, the different productions of different sorts of labor for one another, some allowance is commonly made for both. It is adjusted, however, not by any accurate measure, but by the higgling and bargaining of the market, according to that sort of rough equality which, though not exact, is sufficient for carrying on the business of common life.
Before we get too confused, let's return to our illustration. Your friend the brewer wants 50 loaves of bread for his gallon of beer. That's ridiculous, you say. The amount of labor it takes me to bake 50 loaves of bread is twice the amount of labor it takes you to brew 1 gallon of beer. Perhaps, replies the brewer, but brewing requires great skill, which takes years to learn, whereas any moron can learn to bake bread in a few days. There is no exact way to settle this controversy, according to Smith. You will bargain and higgle with the brewer, and if you agree to exchange, the price you settle on will roughly approximate the real exchange value of the bread and beer. Let's catch our breath for a minute. Why didn't Smith say this in the first place? Why didn't he say you will bargain and higgle with the brewer, and whatever price you agree on will be the real exchangeable value of the bread and beer? Why does Smith talk about real exchange value as measured in terms of labor, only to jettison this measure in practice? The answer to these questions lies in Smith's basic goal, to explain how a natural, spontaneous order operates in the marketplace. Smith wants to show how a market regulates itself through the invisible hand of self-interested behavior, and this is why he offers labor as a natural rule which regulates exchange value. As the baker and brewer bargain and higgle, each estimates the value of his own commodity in terms of labor, and each defends his own estimate. As the bargaining proceeds, however, there is give and take. The baker is willing to give a little more, and the brewer is willing to take a little less. The actual market price emerging from this bargaining process, Smith believes, approximates the real exchange value. Real exchange value is like a gravitating power attracting the baker and brewer to its level. In this way, real exchange value, measured in terms of labor, regulates market value, the price at which exchange actually occurs. A certain order and regularity thereby emerge in a free market as individuals seek their own gain. Adam Smith defends labor as the real measure of exchange value for another reason. It provides him with an invariable standard of exchange value.
Equal quantities of labor, at all times and places, may be said to be of equal value to the laborer. In his ordinary state of health, strength, and spirits, in the ordinary degree of his skill and dexterity, he must always lay down the same portion of his ease, his liberty, and his happiness. The price which he pays must always be the same, whatever may be the quantity of goods which he receives in return for it. Labor alone, therefore, never varying in its own value, is alone the ultimate and real standard by which the value of all commodities can, at all times and places, be estimated and compared. It is their real price. Money is their nominal price only.
The problems in this argument are legion, and few economists today would agree that equal quantities of labor at all times and all places are of equal value to the laborer. Indeed, most economists would question whether labor can be quantified at all, as Smith attempts to do. But right or wrong, Smith's argument has an important purpose. Smith needs an invariable standard of value to measure wealth. Why? Because in investigating the wealth of nations, Smith needs to discuss the increase of wealth in a nation and the difference in wealth among nations. And this requires a standard of comparison, an invariable standard against which changes and differences can be measured.
In such a work as this, it may sometimes be of use to compare the different real values of a particular commodity at different times and places, or the different degrees of power over the labor of other people which it may, upon different occasions, have given to those who possessed it. We must, in this case, compare not so much the different quantities of silver for which it was commonly sold, as the different quantities of labor which those different quantities of silver could have purchased.
Why doesn't Smith use precious metals, money, as a yardstick to measure wealth? Because money, like all commodities, changes in value according to its abundance.
Gold and silver, like every other commodity, vary in their value, are sometimes cheaper and sometimes dearer, sometimes of easier and sometimes of more difficult purchase. The quantity of labor which any particular quantity of them can purchase or command, or the quantity of other goods which it will exchange for, depends always upon the fertility or barrenness of the mines which happen to be known about the time when such exchanges are made.
This is why the price we pay in money is the nominal price, that is, the price in name only. Labor, on the other hand, is an invariable yardstick by which we can measure the increase in a nation's wealth and the difference in wealth among nations. Labor is the real price we pay for everything.
Labor, therefore, as it appears evidently, is the only universal, as well as the only accurate measure of value, or the only standard by which we can compare the values of different commodities at all times and at all places.
You may have noticed that Smith's idea of labor as a measure and standard of value is highly abstract and difficult to understand. Smith noticed it too.
The greater part of people understand better what is meant by a quantity of a particular commodity than by a quantity of labor. The one is a plain, palpable object, the other an abstract notion, which, though it can be made sufficiently intelligible, is not altogether so natural and obvious.
Smith undoubtedly committed errors, significant errors, in his theory of value. But there are degrees of error, from idiotic to brilliant. If Adam Smith made mistakes, they were usually intelligent mistakes, and they were often mixed with important insights. Where Adam Smith was wrong, we are challenged to ask why he was wrong. we can learn from the errors of Adam Smith. And this is a mark of greatness. We hope you have enjoyed this presentation of The Wealth of Nations from the Audio Classics series by Knowledge Products. This continuing series of cassettes presents the major ideas of great thinkers with a discussion of their historical and intellectual context. The script for Tape 3 of The Wealth of Nations is by George H. Smith. Narration is by Craig Deitchman. Voice characterizations are by Dan Church, Rob Daniel, Travis Hardison, Joe Keenan, and Paul Meyer. This material may not be copied in whole or in part without the written permission of the copyright owner. Copyright 1985 by Carmichael and Carmichael Incorporated. Knowledge Products presents The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, Tape 4 of a 4-tape series. The Wealth of Nations is not a simple book, but then you probably know this by now. After all, it has challenged professional economists for over two centuries. Let's continue where we left off, with Adam Smith's theory of value. Unfortunately, things don't get much simpler. Many people have said Adam Smith wrote an important book. No one ever said he wrote an easy one. When we wish to exchange, according to Adam Smith, we need a measure to determine the value of what we have relative to the value of what we want. Labor, he argues, provides an invariable standard to measure equal value. And though it cannot be applied precisely in practice, it functions as a natural level toward which market values gravitate. This approach to value theory is sometimes called a labor-embodied theory, because real exchange value is said to be determined by the labor embodied in a commodity. It is not clear whether Smith would have been happy with this label, but it seems a fair description of the following argument.
In that early and rude state of society, which precedes both the accumulation of stock and the appropriation of land, the proportion between the quantities of labor necessary for acquiring different objects seems to be the only circumstance which can afford any rule for exchanging them for one another. If, among a nation of hunters, for example, it usually costs twice the labor to kill a beaver, which it does to kill a deer, one beaver should naturally exchange for or be worth two deer. It is natural that what is usually the produce of 2 days, or 2 hours' labor, should be worth double of what is usually the produce of 1 day's, or 1 hour's labor.
Smith will have occasion to refer to this early and rude state of society many times throughout The Wealth of Nations, so we should understand what he means by it. This is a primitive economy, an economy without an advanced division of labor. This early and rude society is not an idyllic Garden of Eden or a pastoral paradise. On the contrary, it is, at best, a subsistence economy, where life is hard and comforts are few. We have seen how Smith believes the poorest member of a commercial society is better off than the richest member of a primitive society. Smith's discussion of an early and rude state of society is offered as a model of this primitive economy.
In this state of things, the whole produce of labor belongs to the laborer, and the quantity of labor commonly employed in acquiring or producing any commodity is the only circumstance which can regulate the quantity of labor which it ought commonly to purchase, command, or exchange for.
In the early state of society, the laborer keeps the whole produce of his labor. Socialist writers, after the time of Smith, thought this sounded pretty good, because they believed the laborer is entitled to the whole produce of his labor. Indeed, some 19th century socialists actually praised Smith for his supposed recognition that capitalism led to the expropriation of the laborer's produce. This interpretation, however, turns Adam Smith on his head. Smith sees nothing praiseworthy in keeping the whole produce of your labor, if your labor produces barely enough to keep you alive in a wretched state. Smith wishes to show how wealth increases to provide abundance for all. A small portion of a million gigantic loaves is better than an entire portion of a single tiny crumb. Next, Smith describes the evolution from a primitive economy to an economy where capital stock is accumulated and land is privately owned. Here, the laborer no longer keeps the whole produce of his labor. He surrenders some of it to the accumulator of capital in the form of profit, and he surrenders some of it to the landowner in the form of rent. As the laborer, capitalist, and landowner cooperate in the production of a commodity, real exchange value is no longer measured by the labor contained or embodied in the commodity. Instead, the measure becomes the labor which a commodity can purchase or command in the market.
The real value of all the different component parts of price, it must be observed, is measured by the quantity of labor which they can, each of them, purchase or command. Labor measures the value not only of that part of price which resolves itself into labor, but of that which resolves itself into rent, and of that which resolves itself into profit.
This is perhaps the most hotly debated passage in the history of economic literature. Adam Smith, critics charge, shifted his theory of real value from a labor-embodied theory to a labor-command theory. Exchange value is now measured by the labor a commodity can command in the market, not by the labor embodied in the commodity itself. This was precisely the criticism hurled at Smith by the famous 19th century economist David Ricardo.
Adam Smith, who so accurately defined the original source of exchangeable value, and who was bound in consistency to maintain that all things became more or less valuable in proportion as more or less labor was bestowed on their production, has himself erected another standard measure of value, and speaks of things being more or less valuable in proportion as they will exchange for more or less of this standard measure.
Modern economists generally accept Ricardo's criticism, but is it a fair one? Did Adam Smith, in the span of a few pages, discard one value theory for another? Admittedly, Smith's argument is complex and confusing, but we needn't accept Ricardo's extreme interpretation. Recall that when Smith speaks of exchange value, he adds phrases like, to the person who possesses it. Recall also that Smith concedes the difficulty of using embodied labor as a measure in practice, because there are different degrees of productive labor. Indeed, in the chapter we are considering here, Smith repeats that skilled labor is worth far more than unskilled labor. Why, then, does Adam Smith shift from a labor-embodied theory to a labor-command theory? Because it is difficult to apply the embodied labor standard to actual market transactions, even in a primitive economy. The difficult becomes the impossible, however, in an advanced economy, where the productive powers of labor have increased dramatically. This explains why the wealth of nations covers the division of labor and its effect on the productive powers of labor before it defends a theory of exchange value. When Smith uses the pin factory to illustrate the division of labor, he estimates that the productive powers of labor in this trifling manufacture may be increased by as much as 4,800 times. This tremendous increase in labor's power makes it impossible to use embodied labor as a measure of real exchange value, even in a rough way. How, then, can labor be used as a measure of exchange value in a complex economy? It can be used to measure the amount of labor commanded or purchased in the market, answers Smith. Let's look at this more closely. You have a commodity you wish to exchange, so you ask yourself, in effect, is the amount of labor commanded by this commodity in the market equal to the amount of labor commanded by the commodity I am receiving in exchange? The labor command measure functions in an advanced economy like the labor embodied measure did in a primitive economy. It serves as a measure to regulate exchange value, an abstract level toward which market values will gravitate. Adam Smith's theory of real exchange value, for all its ingenuity, ultimately fails. Indeed, any theory of economic value based on labor as an objective measure is bound to fail. A labor theory of value wound a tortuous path through